Its purpose went beyond grandeur. It served as a centre for worship and a testimony to the greatness of God who dwells among his people.
This is Mission 66, brought to you by TWR and the Bible Teaching Ministry of Dr. Luis Seau. Today, we're stepping into 2 Samuel, offering timeless lessons of repentance, justice, mercy, and relying on God's guidance. You can follow along with your downloadable study guide at mission66.org. Here's John Matthews with Esther Sisulu to guide our study.
It is so great to join you today as we focus on the first book of Kings, which details the history of ancient Israel during the time of Solomon. Now, his reign was the most prosperous time that Israel ever experienced, and Solomon's temple is looked back upon as one of those wonders of the ancient world. Well, today, our teacher, John Matthews, will bring us chapters 5 and 6 with the theme, A House of Prayer.
Esther, thank you very much, and very warm welcome to Mission 66. Great to be with you today, wherever you are. You are very welcome here with us. And here we are in the Bible book of 1 Kings, where we're seeing Solomon, who's taken over as king of Israel, and he's feeling actually pretty inadequate for the job, so he asks God to give him enough wisdom to be able to lead the nation well. Well, God gives him even more, actually, than he asks for. And he soon earns an international reputation for having a wise and discerning heart, the kind of wisdom that could only come from God. And today, we'll follow the preparations for the building of the temple in Jerusalem, chapter 5. So let's read from verse 1, which says, "Now Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants to Solomon when he heard that they had anointed him king in place of his father. For Hiram always loved David. Solomon sent word to Hiram, 'You know that David, my father, could not build a house for the name of the Lord his God because of the warfare with which his enemies surrounded him until the Lord put them under the soles of his feet. But now the Lord my God has given me rest on every side. There is neither adversary nor misfortune. And so I intend to build a house for the name of the Lord my God. As the Lord said to David, my father, your son, whom I will set in your throne in your place, shall build the house for my name. Now, therefore, command that cedars of Lebanon be cut for me, and my servants will join your servants, and I will pay you for your servants such wages as you set. For you know that there is no one among us who knows how to cut timber like the Sidonians.'" Well, we mentioned, didn't we, in previous episodes, the friendship that King David had with the king of Tyre, whose name was Hiram. Now, Tyre was in what we would know today as present-day Lebanon. And perhaps you've heard even of the cedars of Lebanon. They were known to be enormous aromatic trees. Now, this temple then was going to smell pretty good. And the Sidonians, well, they as well were known as really skilled lumberjacks. They'd float these enormous rafts of logs down the Mediterranean coast to the port of Joppa, then haul them all the way up to Jerusalem. Now, Tyre and Sidon, they were not part of Israel, but David and Solomon did not require that everybody became Judeans in order to have friendly relations. And verse 7 goes on to say that as soon as Hiram heard the words of Solomon, he rejoiced greatly and said, "Blessed be the Lord this day, who has given to David a wise son to be over this great people." And Hiram sent to Solomon, saying, "I have heard the message that you have sent to me. I'm ready to do all that you desire in the matter of cedar and cypress timber. My servants will bring it down to the sea from Lebanon, and I will make it into rafts to go by sea to the place that you direct. I'll have them broken up there, and you shall receive them. And you shall meet my wishes by providing food for my household. So Hiram supplied Solomon with all the timber of cedar and cypress that he desired, while Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 cores of wheat as food for his household and 20,000 cores of beaten oil. Solomon gave this to Hiram year by year, and the Lord gave Solomon wisdom as he'd promised him. And there was peace between Hiram and Solomon, and the two of them made a treaty. King Solomon drafted forced labor out of all Israel, and the draft numbered 30,000 men. And he sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 a month in shifts. They would be a month in Lebanon and 2 months at home. Adoniram was in charge of the draft. Solomon also had 70,000 burden bearers and 80,000 stone cutters in the hill country, besides Solomon's 3,300 chief officers who were over the work, who had charge of the people who carried on the work. At the king's command, they quarried out great costly stones in order to lay the foundation of the house with dressed stones. So Solomon's builders and Hiram's builders and the men of Gebal did the cutting and prepared the timber and the stone to build the house. And then chapter 6 recounts the actual building project itself. 1 Kings 6 says, in the 480th year after the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he began to build the house of the Lord. The house that King Solomon built for the Lord was 60 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. The vestibule in front of the nave of the house was 20 cubits long, equal to the width of the house, and 10 cubits deep in front of the house. Now, what it means by vestibule there is actually talking about a porch, and not to be confused with Solomon's porch, which was a large colonnade that came later on. Verse 4 takes us on, saying, and he made for the house windows with recessed frames. He also built a structure against the wall of the house, running around the walls of the house, both the nave and the inner sanctuary. And he made side chambers all around. The lower story was 5 cubits broad, the middle one was 6 cubits broad, and the third was 7 cubits broad. For around the outside of the house, he made offsets on the wall in order that the supporting beams should not be inserted into the walls of the house. When the house was built, it was with stone prepared at the quarry, so that neither hammer nor axe nor any tool of iron was heard in the house while it was being built. The entrance for the lower story was on the south side of the house, and one went up by stairs to the middle story, and from the middle story to the third. So he built the house and finished it, and he made the ceiling of the house of beams and planks of cedar. He built the structure against the whole house 5 cubits high, and it was joined to the house with timbers of cedar. Now the word of the Lord came to Solomon concerning this house that you are building. If you will walk in my statutes and obey my rules and keep all my commandments and walk in them, then I will establish my word with you, which I spoke to David your father, and I will dwell among the children of Israel and will not forsake my people Israel. So there's a warning here, isn't there, from God, that Solomon and his people were to keep close to God and to his word first, in order for him to be able to dwell among his people. And then the rest of the chapter is a description of the beauty and the majesty of Solomon's great house of prayer. And perhaps try to imagine it as I read now, as it's described here in 1 Kings, verse 14. So Solomon built the house and finished it. He lined the walls of the house on the inside with boards of cedar. From the floor of the house to the walls of the ceiling, he covered them on the inside with wood, and he covered the floor of the house with boards of cypress. He built 20 cubits of the rear of the house with boards of cedar, from the floor to the walls, and he built this within as an inner sanctuary, as the most holy place. The house, that is the nave in front of the inner sanctuary, was 40 cubits long. The cedar within the house was carved in the form of gourds and open flowers. All was cedar. No stone was seen. The inner sanctuary he prepared in the innermost part of the house to set there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. The inner sanctuary was 20 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 20 cubits high, and he overlaid it with pure gold. He also overlaid an altar of cedar. And Solomon overlaid the inside of the house with pure gold, and he drew chains of gold across in front of the inner sanctuary, and overlaid it with gold. And he overlaid the whole house with gold until all the house was finished. Also, the whole altar that belonged to the inner sanctuary he overlaid with gold. In the inner sanctuary he made two cherubim of olive wood, each 10 cubits high. 5 cubits was the length of one wing of the cherub, 5 cubits the length of the other wing of the cherub. It was 10 cubits from the tip of one wing to the tip of the other. The other cherub also measured 10 cubits. Both cherubim had the same measure. The other cherub also measured 10 cubits. Both cherubim had the same measure and the same form. The height of one cherub was 10 cubits, and so was that of the other cherub. He put the cherubim in the innermost part of the house, and the wings of the cherubim were spread out, so that a wing of one touched the one wall, and a wing of the other cherub touched the other wall. Their other wings touched each other in the middle of the house. And he overlaid the cherubim with gold. Around all the walls of the house he carved engraved figures of cherubim and palm trees and open flowers in the inner and outer rooms. The floor of the house he overlaid with gold in the inner and outer rooms. For the entrance to the inner sanctuary he made doors of olive wood. The lintel and the doorposts were 5-sided. He covered the 2 doors of olive wood with carvings of cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. He overlaid them with gold and spread gold on the cherubim and on the palm trees. So he also made for the entrance to the nave doorposts of olive wood in the form of a square, and 2 doors of cypress wood. The 2 leaves of the one door were folding, and the 2 leaves of the other door were folding. On them he carved cherubim and palm trees and open flowers, and he overlaid them with gold evenly applied on the carved work. He built the inner court with 3 courses of cut stone and 1 course of cedar beams. In the 4th year, the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid in the month of Ziv. And in the 11th year, in the month of Bul, which is the 8th month, the house was finished in all its parts and according to all its specifications. He was 7 years in building it. So all the planning, all the preparation and the work of thousands of skilled craftsmen coming then to its culmination here with Solomon's Temple, which was considered at the time one of the wonders of the ancient world.
Well, thank you so much for staying with us right here on Mission 66. And John, this is quite the description of Solomon's Temple, isn't it? It's quite opulent as we listen to the descriptions of how it's built. But as we get into our question and answer time, I think let's go ahead and start by talking about who Hiram was. And, you know, I think it's important to start with him because he appears in the story as the one who furnished the whole building materials of the temple.
Yeah, Hiram was the king of Phoenicia, and the capital of Phoenicia was Tyre, and he was on friendly terms with King David, and so Solomon kept that relationship going. There is another possibility, actually, because there were two Hirams. In fact, scholars believe that the name Hiram actually refers to a dynasty in Phoenicia, so it could represent different kings, one in the time of David and then perhaps another in the time of Solomon.
So there was this close cooperation in bringing in of the materials here, because I wonder if that perhaps was the mutual interest in this entire endeavor.
Yeah, Tyre benefited greatly, didn't they, from their association here with Israel. The Phoenicians, well, they were known for being traders and seafarers. And now they were accomplished shipbuilders. And that's probably why they gained a reputation as decent woodcutters as well. Ships would have been, by and large, they would have been wooden in those days. And they also knew the trade routes, and they were very astute as well when it came to commerce. And they were peaceable, and that obviously would have been a helpful thing because it contributed to their success as traders. They'd already established this healthy relationship with David. And since Israel was a stronger, more powerful nation, it made a lot of sense for Hiram to work with a nation that had this standing, this influence. So commercially, yeah, they had plenty to gain from the partnership. From Israel's point of view, well, the arrangement was also beneficial because Hiram had this access to timber, skilled labour, stone cutters. In fact, pretty much everything that was necessary for the completion of this huge project. And so the relationship worked well, even though the Phoenicians, being Canaanites, actually had a different religion, but it certainly didn't stop them from being partners, yes, but perhaps more than that, friends.
Well, it's wonderful to see that they could work together in this massive endeavor. But what do you think about this? Did Solomon truly understand what God wanted? I mean, what was the purpose of building this entire temple, since it wasn't quite a divine requirement of Solomon?
No, and the conversation around the actual building of the temple began back in 2 Samuel. It was actually David who first felt as though, oh, look, I need to construct a place to house the Ark of God. And David says to God, look, Lord, I'm living in a nice house, but the Ark of God is stored in tents. So there was certainly a sincere desire, David wanting to provide this more permanent, established structure for the Ark of the Lord and those sacred objects of Israel's worship. So there was certainly the desire to honour God and to affirm that he was dwelling amongst his people, which he was. Another thing I think that the kings might have thought was, well, look, the Canaanites have huge temples of brick and mortar for their deities, who are not really gods at all. Why shouldn't we then have an even greater building for the great and only God? You know, look, the reality is, as he replied to David back when he first asked, God doesn't need a big plush place to endure and to live, because he is everywhere, he's omnipresent. And but there was certainly a desire, I think, to honour God in this way, even though that desire and the suggestion came from David.
Right, yeah. So we've heard about the putting together of the temple, but let's get to the heart of who designed it.
Well, yeah, God himself actually provides the model once the decision is made to make this temple. He provides the model for construction. It's laid out in the same floor plan of the tabernacle, and it would have had a holy place for the congregation to gather and worship, and then a most holy place, which was hidden behind a great thick curtain, and it was there that the objects were to be placed inside in that place, and there would be the cherubim, the lampstand, the altar, the wash basins, and so. The primary purpose of the great temple was to really strengthen and establish the unity of the people. You know, it was for them, ultimately, religiously, socially, nationally. And Jerusalem had become this location, this central location for this house of prayer, and people would then come from all over the world to see it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was such a sight to see. Now, John, you did mention something earlier. You called it Solomon's Temple. Now, was this part of the temple design, or perhaps was it something that came a little later?
Yeah, that was later, because there was this small porch in front of the Grand Temple, but that wasn't the colonnade that was known as Solomon's Porch. That was to be built adjacent to the Second Temple, which was actually built much later during the time of Ezra, and then that was refurbished by Herod later, again in the time of Jesus himself. Well, that was one of the few places in Jerusalem that was large enough to hold a crowd. And it was actually where the early church would gather when we reach the book of Acts.
John, there have been some observations made about the building of the temple. And, you know, many people have observed that Solomon was using slave labor to build it. Perhaps you can speak into that and give us some understanding.
Well, look, the workers were conscripted. Solomon drafted three times the number of workers needed for the wood and stone cutting around Tyre so that they could work in this shift. So the idea was that nobody would have to be away from home for extended period of time. In terms of trying to apply our understanding of slave labour, and the actual term in the passage is forced labour, we can't. You know, that's something that is against the way that we would try and work society now, and it's certainly against what Jesus stood for. So some of the things that happen in the Bible, we just can't explain, and I think it would be foolhardy for us to try to do that. And so, yeah, it's one of those things that's hard to get your head around.
Yeah, and I really do appreciate you for just pointing that out to us, that sometimes we just won't understand. But I would like to comment on something that the text talks about. It says that no hammers were used in the building of this temple. That's correct, right?
It's what the indications there suggest. It says the stones were shaped before they came on site. It's quite something, this. So it could be that the construction was with interlocking pieces, and I guess if it were ever knocked down, it then could be reconstructed and reassembled. But yeah, there was no sound of stone being chiseled or cut or hammered within the temple in itself, which, given the day, and obviously there was no electricity or anything like that, or electricity driven machines or powered machines, it would all have been done by pulleys and ropes. It's quite something.
It is. And over and above that, there was no iron that was used in the temple. Now, why was that the case?
Well, iron was, you know, associated, Esther, with war. And God had expressed that his temple needed to be a place of peace, a house of prayer for all nations. And so, you know, he rejected David as the one to build the temple because David was seen as this warrior, while Solomon, though, was seen as a man of peace. And so God saw it fit that Solomon was the one to build the house of peace because he was a man of peace.
Oh, this was great. Thank you so much for this, John. I suppose this is one for the architectural enthusiasts, but nonetheless, it's so important for us to get a sense of this temple that Solomon created. Now, how should we summarize these two chapters that we've read?
Yeah, thanks, Esther. So let's do that. And today we were looking at chapters 5 and 6 of the first book of Kings, and the theme was a house of prayer. Now, this episode highlighted Solomon's rise as king of Israel, his requests for divine wisdom to lead, and then his subsequent preparations to build this temple in Jerusalem, a house of prayer and worship for the Lord. Now, Solomon's alliance with this guy called Hiram, who was the king of Tyre, plays a key role in acquiring materials such as cedar and cypress from Lebanon. And that reflects this mutually beneficial partnership despite their religious differences. Now, Hiram's skilled workers and Solomon's conscripted labourers, they collaborate to construct this temple of remarkable craftsmanship, really, and beauty as well, which we've just seen described in detail. And the temple's design follows the layout of the tabernacle, with this holy place for worship and then this most holy place to house the Ark of the Covenant. And the temple was lavishly adorned with cedar, gold, carvings of cherubim and palm trees, and it symbolized God's presence with his people. Thank the Lord for his presence with us, and that he sent his son Jesus to bridge the gap created between mankind and God when sin came into the world. And we also see that the temple would unite Israel religiously, socially, and indeed nationally. Notably, no iron tools were used at this construction site. That reflected its identity as a place of peace, and that contrasted with the association of iron with warfare. And then God warns Solomon that he must prioritize God, worship of God, obedience to God's way, to ensure continued presence of God amongst his people. And the temple then was ultimately completed after 7 years, standing as one of the wonders of the ancient world. Its purpose, well, it went beyond grandeur because it served as a center for worship and a testimony to the greatness of God, who dwelt and dwells among his people.
Well, that is where we leave it for today's episode of Mission 66, but we really look forward to joining you next time, same place, as we move on into the next chapters of 1 Kings, where we continue to see the elaborate furnishings of Solomon's temple. Well, friend, I also want to thank you so much for your prayers and your financial partnership with Mission 66. You know, having you with us, partnering with us in this mission, allows us to reach listeners in multiple languages around the world. Now, if you would like to make a donation to the ministry, please do visit mission66.org. That's mission66.org. Well, friend, from myself, Esther, and for John and our entire team, thank you for tuning in. See you next time on Mission 66.
As we close today's program, take a minute to download your free study guide. You'll be able to follow along every single day. Plus, you can engage with the reflection and application questions so you can apply the teaching to your life. It's a great companion resource to the audio Bible teaching of John Matthews and Esther Sisulu. To get your free study guide, visit mission66.org. That's mission66.org. You can also support the ministry of Mission 66 when you visit the site. Your gift makes it possible for this great teaching to be heard in many languages around the world. Mission 66 is a ministry of Transworld Radio in partnership with Dr. Luis Seau.